From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Daly City,
Glenmore in Fremont,
East Bay, El Cerrito,
West Oakland,
Richmond, California.
I live in Oakland, California. How you doing?
Coming up, we get schooled on what it takes to lead effectively in the classroom.
Academics is important, but like a huge part is just their literally their personal development as people.
We'll continue our series on Oakland schools with profiles of the dedicated people who work hard to keep our students engaged.
We're not just reading about rolling, we're actually making things that roll.
With this type of program, kids often have a little oasis of real enjoyment during the day where they can really like, wow, this is just really fun. This is really, I can really enjoy this.
Oakland teachers share their special skills on this hour-long edition of Cross Currents. If you think back to grade school, what memories stick out most for you? I bet you don't remember specific lessons or report cards, but I'm guessing you remember your favorite teacher, the one who made you passionate about books or math or art, the one who really made the lessons comprehensible, maybe even fun. Here are a few teachers that those of us at KALW remember.
So my favorite teacher was Mrs. Abrams from third grade.
My favorite teacher was my sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Barbarar.
Mrs. Jacobs, and she was from New York, and so she called me Audrey.
Barbarar.
What I loved about her was that she treated us like we were, you know, little adults. She would play classical music while we did our homework. And I think she always thought we weren't too young to have a cultured mind.
She gave her students a lot of independence, and so we got to make up our own spelling tests.
I just remember one time I was sick with a sore throat, and I went back to her desk. I think we were having quiet reading time, and she reached into this candy jar that she had on her desk and pulled out a Jolly Rancher and gave it to me to suck on.
I remember I just wanted to pick the longest words, most difficult words, and I remember I picked something like promiscuous or lascivious, not really knowing what that meant, and I got in a lot of trouble.
And it totally blew my mind that I was getting candy when I was sick. And it just sort of made me feel like, I was like, this woman is here to take care of me and protect me, but I get to have candy even though I'm sick right now. And it just kind of made me feel like the world wasn't as black and white as I thought it was.
Those are just a few of our favorite teacher memories, and we'll be sharing more of them with you throughout the show. Today, we're going to be looking at how effective teachers do what they do as we continue our series on Oakland schools with our reporters from Mills College. We'll start at Franklin Elementary in East Oakland, home to almost 800 students. Engaging each and every one of them requires teachers to constantly look for new techniques. Darissa Phipps opens her classroom doors for us to check out her approach. Natalie Meyer brings us that story.
It's nearly the end of the school day at Franklin Elementary in East Oakland, and the second grade students of Darissa Phipps' class are happily chattering away as they wait for the next assignment. Miss Phipps sits at the head of the class with some handouts, waiting to get the students' attention.
I find the kids, you know, charming and entertaining most of the time. And it's really exciting to see them learn and grow and how they change over the year from the beginning to the end.
The students seem excited and genuinely interested as Miss Phipps calls for their attention. They shush each other and turn towards the front. She then explains their assignment to them, a science project that will teach them about the physics of gravity.
Okay. Well, so then let's just talk about wheels. Today, instead of using the disc as a top that spins or a zoomer that spins, or what's the fancy science word for spin?
Rotate.
Oh, rotate. Instead of making something that rotates with this disc, we are going to make a wheel that can roll.
The kids break off into groups and spread out around the room with a piece of cardboard and two clothespins. They're building a ramp. Then they take two plastic discs with a straw to make a wheel and axle system. They're going to roll it down the ramp.
The force of the wheel is moving.
The force of the wheel or the force of the gravity?
Like the force of gravity.
Miss Phipps' students are engaged and enjoy helping each other learn.
Can I add to Joey's?
Yes.
It's kind of like gravity's pushing it down.
Oh, okay. I like that. Yes?
Miss Phipps makes sure that the kids are actively learning.
I do a lot of hands-on activities, like what you saw in science. We're not just reading about rolling. We're actually making things that roll and trying to talk about things that roll and try to use science vocabulary to describe things that roll. But to add something that kind of sounds like another word we had before, axis. But in a wheel system, it's called an axle. Can you please say axle?
Axle.
Phipps says it's good for them to have an image or an object they can attach a new idea or a new word to.
System that we call a wheel and axle.
Phipps has had a lot of training in her 7 years of teaching. Recently, she attended a seminar called the Teachers College Reading Project at Columbia University. At the seminar, she learned several methods for helping students of every type of background learn to read, including students who may not speak English as a first language.
They have little post-it notes, so as they're reading, when they have a question about a word, or they're thinking of another story that this reminds them of, or they notice something about the characters, they write it down. So they have these little brilliant notes stuck all over their little children's literature books. And then it gives you some insight into their thinking as they're reading.
Phipps is completely devoted to her job as an educator and wants her students to leave her classroom each day excited to come back.
I really hope that they walk away with a joy for learning new things and an enthusiasm for learning new things. And it's expecting a lot of second graders, but I still expect it. Okay, so this is important. The shape of the disc helps it roll because the disc is round. What shape is the disc?
Round.
Okay, and that helps it roll. Tomorrow, I'm going to ask you what the difference is between rolling and spinning. Oh, I know. So I want you to be thinking. You're not just going to get the right answer right away, and it's not always about just getting the right answer, that there's this experience of learning new things and trying new things and sometimes not succeeding at first, but persevering and not giving up, because I think that those are skills that they're going to need in life ultimately, that I think will be helpful for them in being successful farther down the line. So that's my sort of long-range vision.
Thinking in long-range terms is also good for kids. A University of Pittsburgh study shows that positive teacher support plays a crucial role in the success of students. The Center for Community College Student Engagement found that good teaching is at the heart of student success. For Cross Currents, I'm Natalie Meyer.
Natalie Meyer is a student reporter at Mills College in Oakland. Did you have a powerful teacher when you were in school? You can tell us your favorite memory at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, or you can let us know online at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. We're sharing some of our favorite teachers with you today, and this next one comes from our engineer, Seth Samuel.
My favorite teachers were Mr. Goodwin, Mr. Lewis, and Wes Funderburk, who were my orchestra teacher, my band teacher, and my private trombone teacher. They instilled in me a love of music. I picked the trombone in sixth grade for no good reason other than it was a funny-looking instrument. And Mr. Lewis was always really, really, what's the word? Like, he enthusiastic and complimentary and supportive. Mr. Lewis was always so supportive of my pathetic sixth grade trombone playing. And I've been playing ever since.
Learning an instrument is often a childhood rite of passage, and it can lead to a lifelong love of music. But in many schools across California, funds for music education have been cut again and again. And that's why the Oakland Symphony decided it was time to step in. Reporter Ryan Zavala has more.
I'm at Franklin Elementary near Lake Merritt.
So, just so you know, this person here, her name's Ryan, and she's a student at Mills College.
That's Catherine Lyles. She's pointing at me in the back row of her music class. A few children shuffle in their seats to get a better look, but most of them resume their work putting their clarinets together.
Okay, let's talk about what the holes do again.
The class of fourth grade clarinet players is moving along smoothly.
Okay. I just play G. Listen. And then when you play G, it sounded like this. Is that the same note?
No.
So how can you make... Was that note lower or higher? The second,
lower.
The second one was lower. So how can you make that note higher? Try. Just try to tighten your embouchure and bring the note... Make the note higher.
Like this.
Lyle's here teaching thanks to that grant from the Oakland Symphony. The East Bay Symphony's aim is to help the economically challenged students engage and reach out to different communities through the Oakland Youth Orchestra and the Young People's Concert. The program has come a long way over the years. Students have the opportunity to participate in OEBS Young Artist Competition and earn the chance to perform publicly with the Oakland East Bay Symphony. Muse sends out professional musicians to Oakland Public Schools who teach small groups and provide individual instruction to students, just like Lyles is doing right now at Franklin Elementary.
You know what? With me, the way I teach, since we want to keep things rolling along, if I don't say anything to you, you're doing it right. Okay. If you're exceptional, I might point you out, but you're doing it right. You need to fix yours. I will say something to somebody that needs to fix it.
I asked Lyles about the first class that I walked in on, a class for the deaf and hard of hearing.
They're really a lot of fun because everything, they experience everything physically, so there's a lot of drumming and percussion, and like the hand percussion I was showing them, you saw how much fun they were having with that, right? And then one of the boys is playing, he has a drum set at home, so he's really proud that he plays. I haven't actually heard him play.
Lyles goes out of her way to ensure that her students have access to instruments that they are really interested in.
But I'm going to set up a drum set soon so that we can hear him. So we just pretty much try to have them enjoy themselves in that class.
Lyles always has the students' best interest at heart. She knows that their enjoyment with the instrument goes hand in hand with how dedicated they will be to the music.
They experience the world so differently, I realize. I sometimes feel less competent than they are because they speak sign language, you know, and I don't. So I'm learning things slowly, but I don't retain it as well as, you know, a child does.
Now she teaches kids of all abilities at Franklin. She says she started teaching music more than 20 years ago.
This district had pretty much eliminated all of the music programs, and the music teachers wanted to get it back, so they hired a limited number of teachers.
But, she says, once upon a time, Oakland had a thriving music program.
Which is what they originally had back in the 60s when music was just flourishing in Oakland. There was the huge, one of the most famous music programs in the country was right here in Oakland.
It was called Pull Out.
Which is to pull the kids out of the classroom like what we're doing here at Franklin. And that works much better. The only problem with that, of course, is that it's disruptive to the teachers because they're leaving their classroom to go to music.
Do the teachers not like that?
Some teachers handle it more than others.
Lyles explains that the music program thrives when teachers are flexible with their schedule and supportive of what the music program offers.
I always say you've got to stay flexible, and some teachers are very flexible. Here at Franklin, everyone is very accommodating.
Miss Lyle says even after 20 years, she's still learning.
It's taken me this long to realize what kids need. It really does take a long time to understand what they're not getting. Like even just this morning, it's the first time I realized that the way that I had them counting and tapping their feet and looking at the measures. We haven't done that before, and I saw that that worked really well. You know, they all got it. So when a light bulb goes off like that, it's exciting. Then I go, okay, I finally found something. Here we go. One, two, ready, go.
Like good teaching, when you get someone to have that aha moment, you know you're on to something. And thanks to the Oakland Symphony, the music will continue to play in schools like Franklin, despite budget cuts.
Let's sing it. F-E-T-Rest.
For Cross Currents, I'm Ryan Zavala.
Ryan Zavala is a student reporter at Mills College in Oakland, where this series was produced. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Today we're talking about effective teachers in Oakland and how they do what they do. As you just heard, some schools deal with budget cuts by eliminating extracurricular programs and music classes. But when the financial situation gets really desperate, class sizes swell and teachers get laid off, which threatens the very education students are going to school to receive. Learning Without Limits is a small public elementary school in the Jefferson neighborhood of Oakland, and it faced having to make those kinds of major cuts in order to survive. But it didn't. Instead, the school chose to become a charter. Skylar Crownover tells us what that dramatic shift meant to its student body and teachers, and how it may have saved it from closing its doors.
Meet Samara Sheever.
My name is Samara Sheever. I'm a second and third grade looping teacher at Learning Without Limits Elementary School.
Looping means Sheever stays with the same class through their second and third grade years. She has been teaching this way for 6 years, and
when I started, we had just founded our school as a small public school within Oakland Unified School District. And the reason why we need small schools is because it allows us to have relationships with our students and with our families in a way that if there are hundreds and hundreds of kids, you just can't maintain.
But recently, class sizes started to swell, and severe budget cuts forced some teachers to be laid off. So in response, Learning Without Limits made a dramatic shift.
Just last year, we converted to becoming a district-sponsored charter school.
By becoming a charter school, Learning Without Limits is able to function outside of Oakland School District's governance and maintain its independence.
The autonomy over our staffing, the autonomy over our calendar, autonomy over our budget, and autonomy over our curriculum so we can decide what we're teaching and when.
Sheever says that these autonomies are critical for the success of Learning Without Limits. Before becoming a charter,
there were layoffs each year. Most of the teachers at our school started their careers here or had 1 or 2 years before coming here. So we were all pretty low on the totem pole. So when layoffs came through, we were disproportionately impacted.
Being a school of mostly young people starting their careers, almost all of the teachers at Learning Without Limits were at risk of losing their jobs. According to Sheever, within the district,
the last hired are the first fired. So a lot of teachers at our school who had 2, 3 years were getting layoff notices or threatened to get layoff notices every year.
Now the school can maintain stability, and its teachers aren't threatened with a pink slip every year. As a charter, Learning Without Limits is able to circumvent the district's policies on which teachers keep their jobs and who gets fired, a choice that was ultimately made to provide the best education and the best resources possible directly to classrooms and to the kids.
Welcome to my classroom.
The teeny tiny ghost cried, "What shall I do? I learned boo and woo at teeny tiny school, but hide and haunt isn't till next year."
It's reading time in Sheever's classroom. But sometimes, a 7-year-old's attention can wander. That's how Sheever gets their focus back, and when she does, she makes it count.
What do you infer? It didn't tell us why we have to infer. Why do you think he said, wait till next year?
Not only is Sheever a really good teacher in her ability to have 7-year-olds understand information and do other higher-level thinking, she says she is extremely involved in each of her students' lives. But teaching is not always so easy to balance and can overrun a teacher's life. For example, as part of the charter school, Sheever must keep her personal phone on until 9 p.m. during the school week so families can contact her.
You know, teaching is hard and it takes a lot of work, and there is a high level of burnout, and I think we're still working to figure out how, as a school, we can set our limits and have boundaries as teachers so that we're not on a burnout path.
The very nature of teaching makes getting teachers off a burnout path extremely difficult.
Teaching is like a gas. It'll fill up as much space as you give it. And so as individual teachers, we need to decide what size container we want to make teaching in our lives. As big as the container is, teaching will fill that.
Shiver has been trying to find the perfect container for her teaching job, and the support of the charter is helping her.
Well, teaching is definitely still a gas for me. It definitely fills every spare moment that I have. But as we've transitioned to charter, we've gotten more support services.
Those support services are things such as counseling staff and social workers to help handle behavioral issues within the classroom, as well as issues outside the classroom that require close work with families.
But it does take some of the pressure off. So it just takes some of those non-teaching jobs away, which just makes it easier to focus on instruction.
Learning Without Limits is still trying to figure out how to help teachers set boundaries while still keeping the focus on kids. But they are also making exciting new changes to help kids in the classroom and to improve learning. For Cross Currents, I'm Skylar Crownover.
Skylar Crownover is a student reporter at Mills College in Oakland. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Oakland has become a sort of test kitchen for charter schools. One of the first in the state opened in Oakland in 1993, and in the past decade or so, the district has gone from having three charters to 33 today. But there are challenges in welcoming charter schools to the city, and it has been a contentious issue in Oakland.
When we talk about charter schools, they really force us to talk about a few big areas that I think are always contentious, not only in education, but in society. They're about economics, they're about funding, they're about power, they're about laborers and unions, and they're about our most disadvantaged youth.
That's Ingrid Sayer-Ochi, director of the Center for Urban Schools and Partnerships at Mills College. I sat down to talk with her about this issue, and she says the controversy is often fueled by misconceptions, like that charter schools are private.
So they're public schools, but they're funded in different ways, and their staff are paid in different ways as well, and they have a different relationship to the normal public school systems, in this case, Oakland Unified School District. So the number one misunderstanding, that charter schools are private. And also another misunderstanding is that all charter schools are similar, and they're very, very different. We have charter schools that come up really from community organizing, very grassroots type programs. We have some that are part of larger charter operators. I think KIPP, the Knowledge is Power program, is probably the most well-known of that.
And one of the controversies around charter schools is the idea that you're privatizing public education. Why is that a criticism?
Well, I think that charter schools are contentious. Really, I think the number one reason is they get at a lot of economic questions, how schools are funded, and also how we see public education. Do we see it as a public good, or do we see public education a little more as a market where you have lots of competing schools competing for students, where you have ideas that in a marketplace of the provision of education, you're going to have new ideas, and those ideas will flow. So it's not just how we fund, it's how we actually really conceptualize this kind of marketplace of education. And I think when people think of marketplaces, they think of privatization.
And one of the questions with Learning Without Limits, I know that one of the board members brought this up, was the idea that charter schools are actually sucking money out of the public school system. Can you explain what that criticism is?
They're not actually sucking money out of the school system. Charter schools get a certain amount of money per student that's at the same level that the average school in the public traditional system would get. I think, however, if we look at Learning Without Limits and a number of other schools, Ascend being another one, were requesting charters at the very same time that the school district was considering a number of very contentious school closures. So there's really a sense often that schools are closing and yet charters are growing. Money is being taken away from the schools that are closing, and money is going into the schools that are becoming charters.
And why are there so many charter schools in a city like Oakland?
I think there's a couple reasons for that. Oakland has been an area that has been very well funded traditionally around a few big reform efforts. The Gates Foundation funded the small schools movement quite actively, and we see a lot of charters emerging out of that small schools movement. I think also because Oakland, like many urban districts, is struggling to figure out how do we serve all of our students equally and fairly. And Oakland has really struggled to serve the most disadvantaged. A lot of very poor, low-income African-American, Latino, and Asian students are really struggling in our schools. And charters are one way of attempting to serve those students better.
And a criticism about charters comes from the Civil Rights Project at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, wrote a report saying choice without equity, charter school segregation, and the need for civil rights standards. And they were arguing that charter schools actually were more segregated than traditional public schools.
Yes, almost all of the reports that are coming out are that charters are amongst the most segregated schools. Now, there's a couple reasons for this. I do think it's very problematic that they're so segregated, but in some ways, many charters come forward saying, we want to serve the most needy students. We want to serve all first-generation college-going students, so students who come from families where no one in their family has attended college. Well, if you use those kind of goals as ways that you recruit students, then you're going to have schools that are full of students where none of the parents have attended college or where all of the students are low income.
Well, and that's another criticism that I've heard about charter schools is that they are self-selecting in that the active parents are going to be more likely to find a charter school option, and that way you're draining away from some of the traditional public schools' active parents, parents who might be very involved in public education.
Yes, I think that critique does resonate for some charters, but I think for a lot of them it doesn't. So I think it really depends on the kind of charter school. I think with some of the schools that are operated more by the larger charter operators, I think that's a little bit more of a compelling argument. I think for some of the smaller, very community-based charters that we see, I think that's like Arise High School, for example, I think that's a less compelling critique. So again, depending on the type of charter school we're talking about, some of these critiques I think are very concerning and really far more valid, and for some charter schools less so. And this gets back at this question of really understanding that there's a wide range of charter schools and that we have to understand each charter school on its own merits and then with particular critiques depending on the school we're talking about.
That's another thing that I'm kind of unclear about with regard to charter schools is that, like you say, there's this vast constellation of types of charter schools and the way that they're run is very different, and the oversight is also often kind of, well, it's not clear to me how all of that works. Is it standardized? I mean, all this is happening at the same time that we're standardizing testing and curriculum in public schools.
Right. Well, oversight isn't standardized in a few key ways. One, you can get a charter from either a local district, from a county, or from the state. So if for example, if Learning Without Limits had not gotten an Oakland Unified School District charter, they could have appealed first to the county and then to the state. So you have different ways of accountability. And also, very, very few charters are unionized. And this has been one of those major areas of contention. We know that unions do provide a lot of oversight, particularly in terms of teachers' work. And so in terms of that question, I think charters really don't have that standard way of kind of oversight and how we look at and how we evaluate different schools.
And is anybody looking to try and bridge these gaps?
I do think there are groups and individuals that want to bridge those gaps. However, because charter schools have become so contentious, it's almost as if they've become this line in the sand, and you're either for or against charter schools. And this has made it really, really difficult to have the real dialogue that we need to about where are charter schools effective, what are they contributing, what are our deep concerns, what do we need to keep a watch on, what do we need to maybe constrain, what do we need to move forward on. And so I think really thinking about first more open information about the range of charters and then really getting at the heart and the difficult debates about what those questions are and those dilemmas. And when those dilemmas are complicated ones like economics, funding, power, they're difficult to have.
Ingrid Sayer-Ochi is director of the Center on Urban Schools and Partnerships at Mills College in Oakland. What are your views on the public versus charter debate? You can let us know on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is a special edition of Cross Currents produced with Mills College in Oakland. I'm Holly Kernan, and today we're taking a deep look at Oakland schools and the effective educators who work in them.
So one of my greatest joys about this job is, you know, watching my kids develop. When they get challenged by something and overcome it, I feel victorious as they do.
That's David Chu. He's a seventh grade teacher at the American Indian Public Charter School. It's part of a statement he made to the school board last month as it debated revoking his school's charter. The school might be closing despite its high-achieving students because American Indian Public Charter administrators were found to have improperly used millions of dollars in school funds.
Vice President Hodge. Yes.
President Kakashiva.
Yes.
The motion is adopted.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ultimately, the board voted to revoke the charter upon strong recommendation from Superintendent Tony Smith. It's unclear how this decision will affect the unique approach that has come to characterize classrooms in American Indian public schools, classrooms like David Chu's. He says his goal goes beyond giving his students a good education. He aims to help his middle schoolers break out of their shells. Mariah McKnight has our story.
Ladies and gentlemen, I forgot, we have our affirmation jar. Once again, raise your hand if I'm not supposed to read yours, if you don't feel comfortable with me reading yours. All right. Oh, this one's for Jining.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Jining is a funny and nice dude. He is awkward sometimes, but he's also cool. Yeah, everybody give a round of applause for Jining.
David Chu is a seventh grade teacher at the American Indian Charter School. Right now, he is reading notes from the affirmation jar. It's a big glass bowl where students put notes about things they appreciate about one another.
I wanted to say that I think Chunyan was very brave to raise her hand and speak in English. I know it must be hard for her. And she is improving. P.S. Guys, give a round of applause for Chunyan.
Chu uses these daily affirmations in order to teach the students confidence, as well as appreciation for one another.
And so students would get to write their different affirmations. It could be anonymous, or they could put their names on there, things that they notice throughout the day, what they appreciate about their peers.
The affirmation jar is really important to Chu because he sees that his students are
constantly performing. And we're talking about, like, you know, performing in terms of academics, performing in their tests and in their homework. And so there's a lot of space for, like, criticism and I guess constructive criticism, but criticism nonetheless. And I feel like it's really critical to just take some time to, you know, affirm that even though, you know, they might not be performing well, they're still, you know, they're still valuable as human beings. And I think that's always important.
David Chu has been teaching at the American Indian Charter School for almost 2 years. He started working at the same time his students entered into sixth grade. The American Indian Charter School is mostly known for its academic rigor and high test scores, but Chu always finds time with the students to relax and enjoy the learning experience.
My name is Evelyn Pham.
Priscilla Tang.
My name is Xiaobing.
What is your favorite thing about your teacher?
He's really funny.
He's funny.
He's a good teacher.
And he jokes around with us to lighten up the mood so it isn't like all studying and everything.
And when he's explaining concepts, it's not like other teachers I had.
Whenever you need help, he will help you. He will try his best to help you, yeah. He's a good teacher.
Not only does Chu teach the enjoyment of learning, he also strongly believes that in order for students to succeed in life, they have to do well, not only in academics, but also to be sympathetic and kind.
You know, that's a big part of my heart. I think, you know, like academics is important, but like a huge part is just their literally their personal development as people.
So Chu has some of his students take on projects outside the classroom. One is writing a book. Another is trying to create a wind turbine that uses solar and water. One student is even trying to crack the code on cancer.
I'm just trying to bring it closer to them, you know, whatever it is, their dreams or whatever it is, to be something that they could kind of access today.
And he wants to build a foundation on which their dreams can become reality.
Giving them skill sets and helping them see themselves, you know, as potential world changers for the world. And I don't know if that sounds too idealistic, but I mean, that's what kind of stirs me on with the kids. So, yeah, my teaching philosophy is very relational. Yeah.
For Cross Currents, I'm Mariah McKnight in Oakland.
Mariah McKnight is a student reporter at Mills College in Oakland. And if you want to give a shout-out to a teacher who inspired you, call and leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message about an inspiring teacher in your life is 415-264-7106. Thank you. You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents, produced with student reporters from Mills College in Oakland. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're featuring stories about teachers who are taking innovative approaches in their classrooms. We've been remembering some of the teachers who made an impact on us. Here's reporter Leela Day.
My favorite teacher was my fourth grade elementary school teacher, Mr. Ober. He taught me basic sign language when I was in the fourth grade. And he also really kept me on my toes because I remember once we went through this whole reading assignment about how the earth is warming because of global warming. And I was daydreaming and I raised my hand and I said, do you know that the planet's getting hotter? And he said, Leela, you know, we've been talking about this for the past half an hour. You really need to pay attention. And it was at that moment in the fourth grade that I realized, like, I really had to be on my toes all the time.
Leela's moment of epiphany might just be timeless. Even as what we're teaching evolves, what makes an effective teacher hasn't changed that much. But the tools for educators are definitely changing. Behind classroom door number 43 at Oakland Skyline High is a high-tech computer lab for students to create digital magic. It has the latest audiovisual equipment, which helps give students an opportunity to explore everything from computer hardware repair to documentary filmmaking. Reporter Teresa Soares takes us into classroom number 43.
When the morning bell rings at Skyline High School, instead of starting the day off in a traditional classroom, a select group of students hurries off to room 43, where they await their next high-tech assignment.
So, today what we're working on is yesterday we started on the Bully project, editing the interviews, and the idea is, out of the 15 interviews there, you want to take pieces from each that you think would look good together in a finished interview piece using your Final Cut Pro skills.
This is Mr. Fry's digital filmmaking class of seniors who have spent the last 3 years in the Computer Science and Technology Academy at Skyline. They're currently working on a project creating a series of public service announcements about bullying.
I think we're ready to wrap up the bully interviews.
Mr. Fry is the director of the Computer Science and Technology Academy. He founded the program in 1998.
It's what we call a career academy, and the idea is to focus on technology, especially dealing with computers and media production.
Okay, so we cut out that one piece that turned that weird color. Now we got, so we put a replacement in here. So now it's lined up with the audio. The video and the audio is lined up, right?
He's still excited about what he does, even after nearly 15 years of teaching.
He's the most enthusiastic teacher. He has the most patience, too, so it makes the video process really easier.
He has humor, so he kind of makes the class fun, and he helps us along the way. But mostly, he just lets us do our things by ourselves.
Yeah, he's really cool. He just knows how to relate to students, yeah.
Those are three of Mr. Fry's students, Karen Amore, Ariana Argijo, and Harold Powell. They're all seniors and have been taking Mr. Fry's classes for the last 3 years. In fact, the program offers a technology class for students in grade levels
10th, 11th, and 12th grades.
Mr. Fry attracts students from all academic levels and abilities.
And we actively recruit students that aren't necessarily doing really well in school. We're trying to find kids that are at all levels. We actually try to balance it pretty well so that we get really high-achieving kids and we get kids that are really low-achieving and hopefully bring them all up and out of the school better that way.
Mr. Fry believes in enhancing the classroom experience through student diversity. The program is fully inclusive, which means it's completely accessible to special ed students at Skyline.
This particular program is really accessible because it's technologically oriented, so people with certain needs, it's easier for them to access.
Mr. Tintler is an inclusion and special education aide at Skyline.
There's a big effort to kind of include everybody in the mainstream classes to help just kind of make it more diverse and help people socialize, which is really cool.
The way this is set up here is that in my room, 43, is that it's a Mac computer lab and 32 new iMacs here. And you can see I have one in front of the classroom here.
There's a lot of really awesome equipment in here. The studio is higher quality than what many colleges and universities have.
We have brand new iMacs that we got last year. They're all, you know, big monsters. I feel like the Wizard of Oz.
For the kids who think school is boring, the Computer Science and Technology Academy at Skyline High School provides them with a creative curriculum that keeps things both fun and exciting.
With this type of program, kids often have a little oasis of real enjoyment during the day where they can really like, wow, this is just really fun. This is really, I can really enjoy this.
Fry Diesel.
What up, Fry?
Fry Diesel. For anybody that's listening, check out Mr. Fry. He's the best teacher in Oakland, guaranteed. He'll make you laugh, he'll make you mad, and he'll make you successful.
For Cross Currents, I'm Teresa Soares.
Teresa Soares is a student reporter at Mills College in Oakland, where this series was produced. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan, and today we're taking you inside Oakland classrooms to meet creative teachers. Here's another one of our favorite teacher memories from engineer Chris Hoff.
There was a 12th grade English teacher. His name is Mr. Cotton at Fremont High School, and he had a really big impact on me. I remember we were in our Shakespeare part of the course, and we were reading Hamlet, and he made all of us memorize a soliloquy of Hamlet's, and we had to sort of come in character and act it out in front of him. And I remember this is like one of the first times I've really had to memorize something, and since then I've memorized tons of things. There's something really nice about memorizing poems or memorizing pieces of literature, and it was all because of Mr. Cotton. And my soliloquy was from the fourth act of Hamlet, where it starts, "Oh, how all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed, a beast no more?" And so forth.
Luckily, pretty much everyone agrees that we can't cut Shakespeare from our classrooms. But in recent years, school districts across the U.S. have had to make drastic budget cuts. Politicians, parents, and teachers have gone back and forth about what to cut and what to keep. But the voices you don't often hear are the students. At Fremont High School, there's another debate going on. The debate team at Fremont High has a voice, and they like to be heard. Bree Sharman takes us to Fremont High to hear what these kids have to say.
Am I short?
Are you tall?
What's going on?
What game is this? Are you black?
Is this shirt comfy?
Why are we doing this again?
Are you blonde?
About a dozen teens at Fremont High School are standing in a circle in their classroom. They are rapidly firing questions at one another so fast they're almost inaudible. This is Fremont High's debate team. Right now, they're doing a cross-examination exercise.
Am I Canada?
Do you like the U.S.?
Am I yellow?
Is your brother Diego?
No, he's not. Is he your brother?
No, I answered the question.
When the exercise is over, the team gets down to the real issues.
Let's brainstorm all the ways that you, the Fremont community, and your families are affected by public transportation. And how could investment in public transportation improve your life?
That's Elizabeth Cierney, the debate coach at Fremont High School. She's been teaching and coaching at Fremont for the last 2 years.
We happen to be in an urban community, and students happen to take the local public transportation system to school. So it's easy for us to find a way to make that connect with them.
These students aren't cross-examining their opponents on topics like foreign policy or the global financial crisis. They're hitting issues close to home and close to heart.
They like being able to argue, and it's very much a student voice class.
Skierney was at Fremont High for only a few months when three of her students pulled her aside and asked her to be their debate coach. Even though she had no experience in debate, she didn't want to say no.
And I was like, so what do I have to do? Can I just sit here in the corner and listen to you guys and just be in the room?
She picked it up quickly and soon began to take an active role in recruiting new members and coaching students, like she's doing today.
But like, why is it difficult to like acknowledge certain groups as equal based on like, despite that there are certain like economic differences and, you know, cultural differences? Because essentially that what happens is that when like these societies are treated as disposable, they just become that disposable. My name is Sir Garcia from the Fremont High School.
Garcia is a senior and the current debate team captain.
I have been debating for 4 years now. For the past 3 years, I have been debating varsity. One part of academics is sort of just like doing all the work, listening to your teacher talk, and another part is sort of like actually speaking on your own part. And I think that debate plays a huge role in that when it comes to sort of like what the students actually think.
Garcia never planned to be on the debate team. The class is an elective at Fremont, and Garcia came into the school with a different idea of what he wanted to do.
The GROTC program that I was in, I was the battalion commandant, that also got cut.
Along with almost all the other elective classes at the school. Debate at Fremont is mostly funded by the Bay Area Urban Debate League, and is now one of the few electives remaining.
Well, at first, I didn't want to be in debate. I perceived it as what many see debate as, like, sort of like this nerdy activity that only, like, really smart people do.
Garcia's attitude changed when he took debate, and that happens a lot.
Well, I remember that when I was in high school, I was kind of an average student. I was a C student most of my high school life.
Juan Carlos Ramos is an alum and a former member of Fremont High's debate team. He comes to practices once a week to mentor the team.
I wasn't really into the whole going to class and, you know, doing the average thing. So I definitely, it gave me a structure of discipline, and it gave me a place where I can kind of feel accepted and kind of be heard at the same time.
Once students know what debate is, I think a lot of them would choose to do it.
Why do you think that is?
Because they get to talk. The adults shut up.
And it's when the adults stop talking that the real value of a young person's view comes through.
If we're looking at the outcome of debate and the reason why we should invest in debate is because ultimately we're creating a well-informed group of young people who can go on and advocate for their communities.
But before they can advocate for their communities, Teacher Cierney says their country needs to advocate better for them. Listening to the students is one way to start. For Cross Currents, I'm Bree Sharman.
Bree Sharman is a student reporter at Mills College in Oakland. Did you have a powerful teacher when you were in school? You can tell us your favorite teacher memory at our tip line. Just call 415-264-7106 and leave us a message. That number again is 415-264-7106, or you can let us know at our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And this is one of our volunteers, Alyssa Kapnick, with her favorite teacher memory.
I had this teacher in 11th and 12th grade. Her name was Miss Crawford. And she really cared about writing. It mattered a lot to her that you were a good writer. And my favorite part of the class was we read Sound and the Fury. And she went through it with us page by page. So you were supposed to read it at home, but then we would come in every day to class and she would literally comb through every sentence with us. And that book is the most marked up book I have, and I will never get rid of it. And it made me want to study English, which I went on to do in college.
Alyssa remembers that first book she fell in love with. Do you remember yours or your first art project? Do you remember the feeling of creating an object with clay or compiling a collage? In classrooms across Oakland, teachers and students are working together to keep art in the classroom. Reporter Alexandra Shepherd takes us to an arts program at Oakland High School that manages to continue inspiring and supporting young people.
Okay. Once you have your bus pass for me, go with Mr. Spinka. Okay, and we'll start getting you on the buses.
It's a recent Friday, and a group of 10th graders from Oakland High School are preparing to start their weekend with a field trip to the Oakland Museum of California. This mob of loud and animated students crams into the bus. When we reach our destination, the kids rush off the bus and dash up the steps to the museum.
Hi guys, how are you doing?
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to the Oakland Museum of California. So if you might...
We tour the exhibit that celebrates Dia de los Muertos and then find ourselves exploring a show about 1968, that tumultuous year in American history. Some of the artwork resonates with students and makes them think about their own community, like when Irene Benchat sees an altar.
The Brett Cook one about little Bobby Hutton and the quote, we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace.
Bobby Hutton was killed by Oakland police at the age of 18. He was one of the first members of the Black Panther Party. This altar is dedicated to him.
It shows how the community can work together and put a beautiful art piece like this together.
Student Ashley Gaines was impressed by the stories in the 1968 exhibit.
Because it had a lot of places where I could learn more and experience what they was going through.
Learning. That is what this program is all about, and this field trip provides an example of an alternative way of educating students.
I think what we have to offer is that students are able to learn through other modes, you know, in art class.
That's Daniel Spinka, the co-director of Oakland High School's Visual Arts and Academic Magnet Program, or VAMP.
Kids need an outlet, you know, a visual outlet or a hands-on outlet. And, you know, that's kind of where I come from as a teacher. You know, I'm really about what it's like for the classroom dynamic and what the environment brings to the student while they're in here in order to create that enrichment for their education.
Spinka wants students to feel capable of success.
I want my kids to walk away knowing they can succeed, knowing that even if they're that kid that dropped out, or even if they had a low GPA or whatever it might be, that they have the tools to succeed.
Students call themselves Vampers.
My name is Alex Bojorge.
My name is Carifer Rodriguez.
My name is Yesenia Garcia. You really get to express your feelings in art, and even if you can't draw, like I can't really draw, they're not going to be like, oh, you can't draw, get out of VAMP. That's why you're there to learn.
VAMP is not only about art, but it's also because of education, and the more you learn in VAMP, you know, the better your education is going to be.
I really love how you get to express yourself, you know, use art and implement it into your studies, and like, you know, if you need help on something, they'll come over and they'll help you out.
I want to show people how creative-minded I am, show people how I can change a lot of their minds with my hands.
I struggled a lot at home, so I started putting myself into artwork, and I really enjoy painting, so I got really focused into that.
Despite the passion art fuels, Teacher Spinka says funding is in short supply.
Our department hasn't received any funds for supplies in over 3 years. And that's hard. You know, you can only scrap up as much as possible before you have your basic needs that need to be met. So, you know, it definitely gets challenging.
You can see some of those challenges on this field trip. There were no big yellow buses waiting to drive us to the museum today. Instead, the students, instructors, and I had to walk down the block to the AC transit stop and get on the number 18 bus. Art programs are being cut across California, and they are often the first thing to go when budgets get tight. But by talking to students, I've seen that this curriculum clearly has a powerful impact on these teens. But despite the cuts, creative teachers like Daniel Spinka will continue to find ways to give kids an art education. For Cross Currents, I'm Alexandra Shepherd.
Alexandra Shepherd is a student reporter at Mills College in Oakland, where this series was produced. You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents featuring Oakland teachers and innovative programs in schools. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's my co-host, Hannah Ababa, with one more favorite teacher story from our newsroom.
I think my favorite teacher would have to be my second grade homeroom teacher, Mrs. Johnson. She just always made sure that my culture was represented in the various projects that were happening in class, that, you know, whenever Christmas time or Hanukkah or any of these other religious holidays came around, she always asked me to make a presentation about Muslims and what they do, you know, and despite this being kind of in 1980s Texas, where there wasn't much diversity, but she always cared about diversity in the classroom, and that's why I love her.
If you want to give a shout out to a teacher who inspired you, call and leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106. You've been listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KLW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Ray Sue Sussman, Judy Silber, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, RJ Sloan, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And now it's time for local music, but today it's not music from the San Francisco Bay. We had a Super Bowl bet with WTMD, a Baltimore public radio station. And now that the Niners lost, we're paying our debt by featuring Baltimore bands all week. That's why you're listening to the song Tin Man by the Baltimore band Future Islands. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. You're cool.